It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hello, and welcome back to Story Collider's Stories of COVID-19 series. Today, we're bringing you part two of our episode on cooperation. If you missed part one, we shared a story from researcher Diana Bertol Garcia, who was in the Patagonian forests with her research group when she received a satellite phone call telling her they needed to return home due to a pandemic. And we had the opportunity to interview Athena Actipus, a psychologist who has been studying cooperation during the pandemic. If you didn't get a chance to listen yet, I highly recommend going back and checking it out. For now, we have two more stories for you on the theme of cooperation. Our next story comes from neuroscientist and Story Collider senior producer Paula Croxon. It was recorded in the living room of her New York City apartment.
It's early April 2020. And I'm walking north through Harlem toward the hospital. I'm wearing a face mask that I stitched last night out of some old bed sheets and a piece of ribbon. And as I'm walking, I realize I've made my face mask wrong. It's clinging to my face and it's really tight and I can't really breathe properly. So here's the thing. I haven't actually been outside my apartment for over 2 weeks at this point. A couple of weeks ago, back in mid-March, I wake up with a fever and whole body aches, and I've completely lost my sense of smell. There are no COVID tests available for people with mild symptoms, so I just quarantine myself for 14 days and hope for the best. And as I'm starting to feel better, I see the call for volunteers to go in and help out at the hospital. I call my family to talk it over with them. And when I call my dad, he tells me that he doesn't want me to go in, but that if he was in my position, he would do it, and he understands why. At the end of the call, we're both in tears. I don't think I've ever seen my very British dad cry before. But even before I've hung up the phone with him, I know that I'm going to go in and do it. I just feel as if I have to do something to help. I have a PhD in neuroscience, so I have almost zero useful skills in an emergency. But what I do have going for me is that I'm low risk, or maybe I've even had COVID. I live alone, and I live exactly 30 minutes walking distance from the hospital. So I find myself walking north through Harlem, and I realized that there's nothing wrong with my face mask. I'm just panicking. I'm panicking because I haven't been outside for 2 weeks. I'm panicking because I haven't seen anybody for over 2 weeks. And New York is a very different landscape now. As I approach the hospital, I walk past rows of white tents. I can only imagine what they're for. Once I get into the lobby, the panic of the walk turns into an eternity of waiting for the supervisor to come meet us in the lobby, waiting downstairs in an empty meeting room while people rush around us. I should be annoyed that they're making us wait so long. We're volunteering after all, but weirdly, I'm not. I mean, everyone's really busy and really stressed. And also, it's just really nice to sit with another volunteer, another human being, and have face-to-face conversation. Eventually, they remember us, and they take us to the conference center. Except it's not the conference center anymore. There are rows and rows of makeshift beds that have been hastily built with partitions between each pair. And between each pair, there is a huge oxygen cylinder. Our job is to make the beds. We're given piles of sheets that are so well washed that they barely fit onto the mattresses anymore. And we help them assemble this makeshift ward. And the whole time I'm sanitizing my hands and changing my gloves, washing my hands before I use the bathroom and after I use the bathroom and before I take a drink. And at some point, somebody comes around and offers us some dinner. And the dinner is salads. And I'm like, no, thank you. I do not want to eat raw food in the middle of a hospital in a pandemic. The next time I'm in the hospital, I'm in the laundry room, which is where I'm supposed to spend most of my time. I can never find my way to this room through the maze of underground tunnels that we're supposed to follow to get there. And even though it's on the third floor, it feels like it's in the basement. It's huge. It's filthy. There's even a leaking shower in the ladies' room. It's dusty. It's covered in boxes, just scattered around everywhere with no organization because they've received so many donations of scrubs. And our job is to pair the scrubs according to size and stack them ready to be handed out to medical workers as they arrive and leave. So they always have something clean to wear when they're moving from building to building or when they're headed home. It's back-breaking, relentless work. 8-hour shifts at all times of the day and night. The windows jammed open, so sometimes it's freezing. When I get home, I have a routine. I wash my hands even before I take off my mask. And then I take off my clothes and hang them in a bag and leave them for at least a week before I can expose the folks at the laundromat to them. And then I get in the shower and I take as long and as hot of a shower as I can stand. And then I fall into a deep sleep, no matter what time of day or night it is. In New York, there's this thing that people do at 7 p.m. where they clap for the essential workers. They open their windows, they stand on their stoops, they set off air horns. I fucking hate the 7 a.m. clap because that's when I'm trying to get some sleep in between my shifts. In the laundry room too, all of the regular laundry workers are angry. I ask one of them why. She says, well, you're not here to help us. What do you mean? Well, our job is to wash and fold the scrubs that the hospital already has, but you're only allowed to deal with the donations. You're not here to help us, and you're just taking up space that we need. And they don't even wash those ones. They just throw them out after they're done because they're getting so many. This somehow just devastates me. I'm not helping. I'm just in the way. I'm contributing to a huge pile of medical waste. What am I doing here? The next time I go to volunteer, I'm at a different hospital further uptown. And I'm not folding and pairing the scrubs anymore. I'm handing them out as the medical workers arrive and leave. I'm positioned outside the ICU in one of the busiest parts of the hospital. Everyone there is having a bad day too. Everybody's tired. Everybody's busy. Everyone's losing patience. But everyone's kind. They all say thank you. And they all try and smile above their masks. And I begin to realize the importance of finding the right color or the good fabric. Because if I can just find somebody, the ones with the pockets that they like, then I can make their day just a tiny bit better. And if I can't, I can do my best smize over my mask and tell them I'm sorry and that I'll do better tomorrow. And everyone's just so normal. They're riding packed into elevators because they don't have time to wait for the next one. And they're FaceTiming with their friends and family as they walk down the corridor. And they're sitting in the break room eating salad. And they're goofing off underneath two masks and a face shield and gloves and booties and a gown. And sometimes when I hand somebody a pair of scrubs, my gloved hand touches their hand. And I'm like, oh, because that's the only human contact I've had. I'm prepared to see patients come into the ICU in a really bad way. And I'm even prepared to see patients leaving with a white sheet over them, even though I know what that means. But what I'm not prepared for is toward the end of my time there in May, they start to let a couple of visitors come in. Their faces as they leave, the way they hold onto each other, it's like they've lost hope. And there's nothing I can do for them. I'm just sitting there in the corridor with my pile of scrubs, eating my fucking salad, and there's nothing I can do or say. One day I'm sitting there as usual, and I hear music playing over the PA, which is weird because I've literally never heard them use the PA for anything the whole time I've been there. But then it stops, and I think it must have just been a glitch. And then about half an hour later, I hear the music again. But this time it's playing from someone's cell phone. It's that song by the Black Eyed Peas, you know, I got a feeling that tonight's gonna be a good night. And I look around to my right and I see it's got to be 20 medical workers coming down the corridor, and they're singing and they're dancing and they're clapping. And they have a patient with them in a wheelchair who I find out has been in the hospital for over 30 days. And he's being just discharged. They play the music when they discharge a patient. And they look at me and they want me to sing and dance and clap too. And so I do.
Paula is a neuroscientist, science communicator, musician, and open water swimmer. She is a senior producer with the Story Collider in New York and associate director for public programs at Columbia University's Zuckerman Institute. And Paula is multi-talented. She is also the flautist in alternative rock band Marlow Gray and nerdy rock band Pavlov's Dogs. Before we move on to our final story of cooperation, I want to remind everyone yet again that Story Collider hosts monthly online storytelling workshops. If you're looking to develop your storytelling and communication skills or find a new community during the pandemic, I highly recommend checking them out. Registrations are now open for our December courses. Find out more at storycollider.org. Our last story on the theme of cooperation is from Kiani Conley-Wilson, an organizer and assistant program manager at the Soulfire Farm Institute in Troy, New York. This story was recorded inside a closet in her home in Troy.
It was a chilly afternoon in late January of this year. It was my first day at Soulfire Farm. I was so excited to finally be working for an organization that is committed to ending racism. And I get to work on a farm. I love getting my hands in the dirt and just connecting with folks and talking to people. And that's something that I could 100% see myself doing in this new position at Soulfire Farm. And we're gathering for orientation, and I get to meet all of my coworkers, some that I know, some that are new. And I'm really excited for this opportunity, as last summer I got to spend a week on the farm and I was just had a big grin on my face the entire time. And I just feel that love and compassion floating over me as I walk onto the land and start my first day at Soulfire Farm. And of course, a couple weeks after I start my job and get into the swing of things, the pandemic hits the United States. I am absolutely beside myself. I have no idea how I'm going to get supplies, get groceries for myself. I know that my closest family is about 3 hours away, so I can't visit them or help them out with fear of spreading the disease as more and more information is coming out. I'm wondering, is this airborne? Is it transmitted otherwise, and there's all this information coming out that's contradictory, so I just shut myself out. I don't see friends or family or anyone really, except for the grocery clerk, for about a month because I'm too afraid to get any of my friends who are immunocompromised sick or just spread the disease and not know it. And as I'm reclusing myself more and more, I'm seeing less and less people. I'm really just going to my house or my garden, and that's it, nowhere in between. And as a social person, that's really difficult for me because I love talking to people. And so I'm getting more and more depressed and struggling. I'm eating ice cream for 2 out of 3 meals. I use that term loosely, a day. I'm binge watching Futurama like it's nobody's business, going through the series at least a couple of times before I'm like, hey, maybe something isn't right here. And I see my therapist pretty regularly, so I'm like, let me talk to someone else. So I call up my old mentor, and we decide to meet by his office outside, but overlooking the Hudson. And he's probably the first person I've seen in a month. So there's that going for me. I'm a little bit nervous. And so we get to talking, and he's like, Kiani, how are you doing? And I'm like, again, first person I've seen in a couple months, I can't let him know that I'm not doing okay. So I'm like, I'm fine, really, really. I'm great, fabulous, no problems here. He sees right through that. He's like, come on, Kiani, how are you really doing? And I'm like, I'm really struggling. Like, I don't know what to do here. There's so much going on, and I just feel completely powerless and hopeless. He says, I know, Kiani. Things are rough. They're rough for everyone. But we need you. What I hear is we need you to lead, act, and just do anything to get us through this. And I'm like, yeah, that's fair. But I'm really tired, so I don't want to do anything. And so I go home with this nagging feeling like, hey, you should do something. You should do something. And I'm like, tomorrow, come on. We get to wallow for one more day. And so I'm wallowing for one more day, and there's this pulling sensation being like, hey, you really need to get out there. And so I start the next morning just brainstorming what are things people are doing around me that I really find inspiring. And I know that we have the Solidarity Shares program at Soulfire where we're giving food to folks in need. But I feel like that's so big. Like, what else are people doing? People are volunteering at the food pantry. They're helping protect workers' rights as more and more workers are being laid off or fired. And they're also helping protect rights of both tenants who might be evicted or just having trouble with their landlords, and gender nonconforming and trans folks, and making sure that they have the rights that they deserve. And I'm realizing, oh, a lot of these people are in DSA. And I'm sure not everyone in the branch knows, so let me write a letter to folks. And so I write a letter telling folks, hey, things are really difficult, like they're even difficult for me, but we have authority over certain things. We have some sort of power. And there are folks just doing small things to make things better for everyone else. And the more things that we do, the more collective power that we have, and the more big of a change that we can make. And so I'm like, don't give up hope. Just try something, check in with folks, and just make sure you're taking care of yourself. And after I write this letter, I'm like, okay, what are things in my life that I have power over? What can I do? And I remember, oh yeah, there's that Soulfire in the City program that I'm supposed to be running. And essentially that program is we build raised garden beds and container gardens for folks in need who have asked for it. And so folks fill out a survey and we review it, and we really prioritize families, folks who are low income, single mothers, and other folks who might have barriers, whether it's affording supplies, getting soil, being able to transport supplies, whatever it is, we want to help them. And so we get over 40 people applying to want a garden, where last year we only made 3 beds. So it's a huge change and shift in how we're working this year. And so I'm like, all right, We got all these people who need help. Let's get these supplies, make sure we got enough wood, soil, plants, and seedlings, and just get this going. And in April, May, we have about 5 gardens being built a week, and we're in full swing. And one family in particular stands out to me because they really taught me a lesson. So it's late April, it's a couple of days before their build, and I'm driving out to deliver some wood and plants to this family. And as I'm driving, I'm like, okay, this is a new area of Albany, which isn't really that unusual. I don't really hang out in Albany all that much. And I pull off of this really busy road into a more suburban area. And I'm like, okay, this area looks like a neighborhood that I really couldn't afford to live in as a kid. But, you know, it's cool. There are kids running around and outside on their bikes. There's all these lawns, but not a lot of gardens, which I'm like, interesting, okay. And so I pull up, and I let them know, hey, I'm here. And one of them comes out and is like, greets me. He's like, hey, how's it going, Keani? You can actually pull up into the driveway because, you know, we got these big pieces of wood that we need to bring out. So don't worry about bringing it all the way up the driveway. And so I pull back, I back up into the driveway, and we get to talking about just the garden, everything going on while we're unloading the wood from the truck. And she's like, yeah, Keani, we're super excited for this. We really couldn't do this without you because we have 2 kids. We both work full time and there's all this other stuff that's going on that we really don't have the time to sit down and figure out how to make a garden. And so I'm like, oh, maybe I misunderstood a little bit. And we're unloading all this other stuff, and she's telling me how excited she is about the garden. And later on, her partner pops her head out, and she's like, hey, Keani, I'm just between calls for work, but I just wanted to say thank you so much. We're so grateful for all the help that you're doing, and we really feel honored to be a part of this program. I pull out, and the kids wave to me, and I wave back, and I really feel grateful for this opportunity to learn about different aspects of barriers when it comes to gardening. And while this is all happening, there's all these protests happening in response to George Floyd's murder. And of course, in Troy and Albany, we're having some as well. So Troy for Black Lives calls for a rally for equality in Troy. And I'm real excited, but I'm also a little bit nervous because I can't really be outside and a giant crowd of people because I'm working with families all the time. And as the timeline diminishes towards the rally, I'm getting more and more anxious. So the Saturday before the rally, there's an action in Albany where folks are just once again protesting the unjust treatment of both George Floyd and local citizens from the police. And it really ends this particular event pretty poorly. The police end up shooting rubber bullets into the crowd to disperse them and then also throwing gas into this crowd. And I'm really horrified. The next day I see a couple friends and I see this giant bruise on my friend's entire thigh. And she's like, oh yeah, I got that from the rubber bullet. Fucking sucks. I'm like, wow, that's horrific. And so a couple days later, a report comes out, and it's this audio from the Albany Police Department. Essentially, it goes like this. There's some kids blocking this bridge. What should I do? Another person calls in. Just run them over. They're just protesters. They don't matter. Their lives aren't important. I hear that audio, and my jaw just drops. Like, wow, these police officers really don't care about us at all. And so my anxiety, of course, is going through the roof as more and more of this information is coming out because my friends are going to be out there and lots of folks that I know around town are going to be at this action. And so I'm thinking, okay, what can I do to make this situation better? And I'm like, okay, I'm not going to be there, but I can at least make sure the folks that I know that are going feel safe and secure at this rally. or at least as protected as I can. So I make this giant laundry list of things that folks can do before and after the rally. I'm like, okay, make sure you eat, make sure you get a full night's rest to make sure you're energized. Make sure you pack some snacks, otherwise you're going to get hungry and you're not going to be able to go anywhere. And then when you get home, make sure you rest and sleep and eat something again. And so I send that off to all my friends and they're like, yeah, this is awesome. This is great. Thank you so much. And the day of the rally comes and I feel like a parent sending their kids off to their first day of big kid school and wave to them as they go by. And so I get in my truck and drive over to the other side of town on the east side where we're set up a command center, essentially, where we got a couple monitors up and laptops. We got our headphones in, listening to the police scanner, and have a group chat with various folks, just making sure that we're touching base and know what's going on. So the rally is going fine. And we realize that there are 11,000 people in the crowd. We see some pictures and we're like, whoa, this is insane. The entirety of downtown is packed. You can really feel the energy, even though we're on the other side of town, of all this excitement and all this movement behind making things better in Troy. And so the day progresses and someone texts me, hey, is there someone on the roof with a sniper? And we're like, what? We haven't heard anything about this. And then the police scanner goes off. 1022. Man on the rooftop of this bar. Not armed. We're like, okay, cool. Not armed. So we text everyone. We're like, this dude's not armed. We're all good. Let's keep going. And so we keep going and, you know, we're still feeling a little bit anxious, getting information here and there about things going on. And then all of a sudden we hear, 1099, Buffalo Boys in Washington Park. They are armed. Repeat, are armed. And we're like, holy shit. We make sure folks know, like, hey, there are these guys, the Buffalo Boys. And we're like, wait, what is a Buffalo Boy? Someone Googles it and they're like, oh, it's white supremacists that wear, Hawaiian shirts. I read that right. We're like, what? Why? What's going on with that? We love Hawaiian shirts. That's a whole look. And so we let them know, hey, there's some bugalos out. They got some, they're apparently armed, so just be careful. And then we hear a couple minutes later, 1099, Buffalo Boys, we got them, we're bringing them out to Rensselaer County. We're like, okay, they're going to be out at Rensselaer County jail. So they got them. That has been de-escalated. The remainder of the rally is pretty, I don't want to say uneventful, but there's nothing that exciting going on. There's not Buffalo Boys with guns. And so we're like, all right. And by the time midnight rolls around, things are still happening, but it seemed like the crowd had dispersed a bit and we go home. And what these two stories tell me are, they really remind me of mycelium. They remind me of this network of mushrooms that live underground that helps plants talk to each other, share nutrients when they need. It's almost like a network of mutual aid that's found in nature. And I find that really compelling and really relatable to what's happening now. We can either lean into our fears and anxieties and just get stuck, or we can lean into hope, trust, love, and compassion, and learn something new. And so I feel very honored to be able to both uphold my values and help others. And I think that's something that we should all strive towards.
That was Kiani Conley-Wilson. Kiani is a grower and organizer based in Troy, New York. She's passionate about environmental justice, anti-racist, pro-feminist organizing, and the power of food across cultures, economies, and environments. She organizes with local organizations to develop people-centered systems and spaces, including a community garden in North Central Troy. After graduating from RPI, Kiani expanded on her knowledge of growing with the Urban Farming Institute of Boston at Community Gardens and Soulfire Farms BIPOC Immersion. The Story Collider is so grateful to Paula and Kiani for sharing their stories. Story Collider is also very grateful for the support of Science Sandbox, a Simons Foundation initiative dedicated to engaging everyone with the process of science. This podcast series was produced by me, Erin Barker, with assistance from Story Collider's Deputy Director Nissa Greenberg and Senior Podcast Editor Jun Chen. Special thanks goes out to Story Collider's board, our operations manager, Lindsay Cooper, and our new interim executive director, Leslie Griesbach-Schultz, without whom none of this would be possible. The stories featured in the second part of this episode were produced by Emma Young and Nissa Greenberg, respectively. The theme music is by Eva Gertz of the Fulton Street Music Group. Stay tuned for our next episode on Friday, Adaptation. Until then, this is Story Collider signing off. Stay safe, wash your hands, wear a mask, love each other, and please do not feel pressured to go to your family Thanksgiving. This year of all years. Thanks for listening.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.